Chapter 4. This is not my sermon text, if you will, but something that I want to read in relation to it. And you'll see why as we read the passage and then get into the sermon itself. Luke chapter 4, beginning at verse 1, and we'll read down through verse 11. Luke chapter 4, beginning at verse 1. Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the desert, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. He ate nothing during those days, and at the end of them he was hungry. And the devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God," and some believe that that could be translated "since," the devil saying, "Hey, you're supposed to be the Son of God, right? Well, since you are the Son of God, then tell this stone to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone." The devil led him up to a high place and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And he said to him, "I will give you all their authority and splendor, for it has been given to me, and I can give it to anyone I want to. So if you worship me, it will all be yours." Jesus answered, "It is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." The devil led him to Jerusalem and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you carefully. They will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone." So I should read two more verses here. Jesus answered, "It says, do not put the Lord your God to the test." And when the devil had finished all this tempting, he left him until an opportune time. Now it's interesting that Matthew's gospel shares the same basic account, and it's also found in the same chapter number, Matthew chapter 4. But here, the order of the temptations is slightly different. And so, if you would turn to Matthew chapter 4, I want you to read just the last part of these three temptations with me, beginning in verse 8, Matthew chapter 4, where the gospel writer says, "Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you," he said, "if you will bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." And then Matthew puts, "Then the devil left him and angels came and attended him." Two slightly different, but of course very similar accounts of what is known as the temptation in the wilderness. And you see that picture on the screen is really a depiction of that time just prior to Jesus' public ministry. I like this picture in particular, not so much because of the drawing of Jesus. That's kind of your typical, you know, white robe, white man, long hair and a beard. But I really like this shadowy figure there on the side, which is, of course, the evil one coming along to tempt him after 40 days of fasting in the wilderness. Now, as you know, we are in the middle of the Lenten season, right? Hopefully that hasn't passed you by. On Fat Tuesday, did you have your punschke? I usually like to do that. I try to avoid punschkes and donuts altogether. I like them, but they don't like me, if you know what I mean. And this year, I happened to be in the grocery store. It was 1 or 2 days after Lent had begun, and I saw some leftover punschkes, and I almost bought them, but I guess I needed to be faithful to the season. So I said, nope, if I missed it on Tuesday, I can't have them. So I didn't have punschkes this season. That's kind of the traditional, I guess, way of entering into the Lenten season. Now, of course, we're pretty much smack dab in the middle of the Lenten season. It began back in February, and it concludes, of course, with Resurrection Sunday coming on April 4th. Now, I don't know what your traditions are here in this church, but I do know that many Protestants don't really tend to pay too much attention to Lent. And I wonder how many really understand the history behind the Lenten season. I know that for many years I didn't. I assumed one thing. For instance, I used to think that the 40-day period of Lent was meant to commemorate the last 40 days of the life of Christ leading up to his death, burial, and resurrection. But it's not. Lent, as you may very well know, emulates the 40 days that Jesus spent in the wilderness being tempted by the devil, what we read about just a moment ago. So, just as Jesus fasted for 40 days, the idea is then that during Lent, we are to voluntarily abstain from some aspect of what we would call normal life that could possibly distract us from focusing on the Lord and on spiritual priorities. And that's why a number of folks will give up TV for Lent. Others will fast from something that may not necessarily be a distraction, but the absence of it just might hurt enough to remind them when the pain comes, if you will, or that longing that they're used to, will remind them to instead turn to the Lord. I used to be rather critical of people who would give up things like TV or chocolate or desserts, and I'm thinking, what's that? Because I thought that Lent meant you were supposed to give up some sort of sin. So my particular saying that I was quite proud of was this: do it for Lent, do it for life. But I have a different understanding of Lent now. Now I understand. I mean, you wouldn't say to Jesus as he goes into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, give up eating and drinking for this period of time and then for the rest of your life too, Jesus. No, it's during this special time of concentrated, focused spirituality where you shed those things that may even be part of the necessities of life, but you remove them for your time in order to focus more completely on the Lord. Or things, like I said, that may distract you, or even if they're not distractions, when you feel the pain of their absence, they remind you to focus on the Lord. And so some people will give up things like chocolate and desserts for Lent, or something else that they might miss, so that when they feel its absence, they might be reminded to pray and turn their thoughts to more spiritual things. So I don't know if you've given up anything for Lent or not, but if you've done something like abstain from cookies, I don't know, that's okay. That's an all right thing. It's not something sort of trivial. It's meant to be something that you can set aside that it will remind you instead to focus upon the Lord. By the way, there's something else that we might not know about Lent or maybe not have noticed, and that actually there are 46 days to Lent. When you add them all up, beginning on the first day, on Ash Wednesday, there are 46 days, not 40. So, in order to make up for those six extra days, each of the six Sundays in Lent are considered as free days. And here's the reason why. According to church history, Sunday is traditionally a feast day, right? It's a day in which you enjoy the bounties of the Lord. And so Sunday being a feast day is not considered to be part of Lent, which is kind of cool. Because, for instance, if you give up TV during the week for Lent, well, then you can binge watch and catch up on all your favorite shows on Sunday afternoon while you're stuffing your face with chocolate ice cream for that day. It's a free day. Now, Lent, as I said, in many ways, is meant to remind us of the reality of temptation. That's the whole purpose. Jesus being tempted in the wilderness, the Lenten season reminding us of the reality of temptation. Some wise, smart alecky wag said once, you know, temptation doesn't bother me at all. I give in to it every time. Well, that's just the problem, isn't it? It's to focus on the reality of temptation and the discipline that is required to say no to things that we want to fast from, even things that are not necessarily evil, like food that Jesus fasted from for 40 days and 40 nights. So we're back to Jesus and his time in the wilderness being tempted by the devil. No doubt you've heard another saying about temptation. It says this, opportunity knocks only once, while temptation beats down the door every day. Sadly, that's true, isn't it? It seems that there are a myriad of situations almost every day where we are tempted to lie, to cheat, to steal, to lust, to judge, or to criticize. You see, temptation afflicts every person who has ever lived, from Adam and Eve to you and me. Even Jesus, as we see here, the perfect and divine Son of God, suffered from temptation. And as one person said, it wasn't like Jesus went through temptation like a hot knife through butter. No, it was real. Remember the scriptures say he was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. He felt the weight of temptation upon him. And not just during those 40 days in the wilderness either. He, like us, had to endure the crucible of affliction and temptation his entire life. Only where we have failed, Jesus prevailed. I want you to look with me at Hebrews chapter 14 on the screen here, and chapter 4 rather, verses 14 through 16, and see what the writer tells us. He says, therefore, since we have a great high priest, that of course is Jesus, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Therefore, or let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. When you are tempted, you can't say, nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody has been tempted like I have been. Look to the Son of God in every way. It doesn't mean that he suffered every single temptation that you face, because there are some temptations that face us today in the year 2021 that didn't even exist in the year 30 AD, if you will. But he was in every way, in every fashion, tempted just like we are. Now remember, a little bit of historical theology for you. Remember that sin came into the world because Adam and Eve not only were tempted, but gave in to the temptation of the devil, the serpent, who told them, when you eat this fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will be like God. And they were tempted and gave in to it. But Jesus, who Paul called, by the way, as you know, the second Adam, right? Jesus, the second Adam, prevailed over the evil one when he came with his seductive offers, not only in the wilderness, but all through his ministry. And so I believe that many, if not most, of those temptations came in the form of dangling suggestions that Jesus could somehow avoid and bypass the pain and disgrace of the cross. I think all of the temptations centered in that one basic theme. And let me explain to you why I think that as we go on this morning. You see, I believe that Satan knew that the cross would be his undoing. I really do. I know there's some disagreement about that. You know, did Satan want Jesus to die? So was he the one who forced Jesus to the cross? And, as some songs talk about, the demons were just carrying on and partying and all happy and, joyful that he died. Or was it the fact that Satan did not want Jesus to die and did everything he could to keep him from the cross because he knew that's where redemption would be accomplished? I tend to take that latter view, and I'll show you why this morning. Satan is a much better student of Scripture than any of us, first of all, right? I mean, just simply because he's been around longer, but also he's a very intelligent being that God created. So I believe that Satan knew that Jesus would do just what Paul said in Galatians. He would disarm the powers and authorities and make a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in the cross. Satan knew that's what would happen. So he fought tooth and nail against the cross, beginning with trying to kill the baby Jesus as soon as he was born. Remember that whole thing with Herod and the Magi and all of that business? And how Herod killed every baby boy 2 years and younger? Satan was behind that. And well, when that didn't work, he relentlessly tried to convince Jesus to circumvent the cross, as we see so clearly, not just in the wilderness account, but also in other places throughout the Gospels. But because Jesus prevailed where Adam failed, and where you and I have failed as well, because Jesus prevailed, we are freely forgiven and accepted by God through the cross of Jesus Christ. Now, I want to get on my horse and ride, because I don't have a lot of time with you this morning, but I do want to gallop through at least six episodes recorded in the Gospels where Satan came at Jesus with everything he had to get him, to tempt him to bypass the cross. But, as we see on our screen now, Jesus prevailed against Satan's temptation to avoid the cross. Jesus prevailed. We've got to remember that. And so first, we see Jesus prevailed in the wilderness temptation. That's the most obvious one. That's the passage that I read. And I took us to Matthew's gospel last of all because I want us to see there that that final temptation where Satan showed him all of the kingdoms of the world and said, all of this is yours if you will just bow down to me. That final temptation was really a ploy to get Jesus to bypass the cross. I believe that all of the temptations in the wilderness culminated in that suggestion. Jesus could receive the adulation and the praise and all the kingdoms of the world. Isn't that what God has promised to His Son? Isn't that going to happen anyway with Jesus eventually, right? God is going to turn over all the kingdoms of the world. And even in Revelation it says, the kingdoms of the world have become the kingdom of our God and of His Christ. Satan wanted to bypass the cross and said to Jesus, here they are, they're all given to me. I will give them to you right now if you bow down and worship me. That was Satan's ploy to get Jesus to receive the benefits of the redemptive work without having to actually do the redemptive work. You don't have to die, Jesus. Right now, I will give it to you. But instead, we saw a moment ago in Hebrews that Jesus says, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. He scorned its shame. And so that's why Jesus said to Satan, away with you. Or if you will, he said, get lost, Satan. That's in essence what he said. Go away. Leave me alone. But as we saw in our gospel reading from Luke, this was not the final encounter between Satan and Jesus, nor was it the last time that Jesus was tempted. Look what it says here. I'll remind you again. Luke 4:13. When the devil had finished all this tempting, he left him until an opportune time. Satan just took a step back and thought, I'll wait again. There will be another opportunity for me to come at him hard. And he did all through his ministry. So another example, the second example we see is this. Jesus prevailed against Peter's opposition, Peter's rebuke. Look with me in Matthew chapter 16. Actually, we just look at it on the screen here. And this is what we are told in the middle of Jesus' ministry. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life. He's starting to instruct the disciples. This is what's going to happen. He's beginning to let them in on really his redemptive purpose. We go to the next screen and we see Peter's response. Peter took him aside and he began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, he said. This shall never happen to you. Oh, Peter, he's something else, isn't he? He's bold, if not foolish, but he is foolish too, I'm afraid. So we're told this, Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Why did he refer to him as Satan? Was he just, you know, sort of in a bad mood? You know, "You're the devil." No, Jesus chose his words carefully. He said, "You are a stumbling block." You know what a stumbling block is? Something put in your way to trip you up. In other words, a temptation. "You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." In other words, Jesus recognized that Satan himself, the devil, was behind Peter's words, saying, "This will never happen to you. This came in the form of a temptation." How much do you think Jesus really wanted to go to the cross? I mean, he knew it was the Father's will, but did he want to do this? No, not in one sense. That's why in the garden he said, "Father, if it be your will, let this cup pass from me." So when Peter comes and he recognizes it as Satan behind him saying, "You don't have to do this," Jesus was upset. "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block. You're trying to tempt me here." Jesus wasn't just calling Peter names. He recognized that this was really the evil one behind his words, tempting Jesus again to somehow avoid the cross. Let's look at another example, too, as we fast forward a little bit. Jesus prevailed in his final week before the cross. Now, we've just moved quickly through 3 years of ministry of Christ, and now it's the final week before the cross. It was just after the day that we call Palm Sunday. You know, when Jesus rode triumphantly into Jerusalem and they laid down the palm branches before him and Hosanna to the, you know, all this business. Palm Sunday. This was just a couple of days afterward, and this interaction occurred in John chapter 12. Jesus said, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And now my soul is troubled." Yeah. "And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour?" He's talking about the cross. "What should I say? Deliver me from this God?" He says, "No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out." What shall I say? Save me from this hour? Who do you think planted the temptation to ask that question? You know, when Jesus said that, it wasn't just some sort of rhetorical possibility, you know, just something out there in the realm of never, never land that would ever, never really happen. Jesus is saying, this is what is being thrust upon my soul right now. I mean, he said, my soul is troubled. It wasn't that he just went to it like there's nothing to it. My soul is troubled, he said. What am I going to say? Save me from this hour? No, because he knows that the evil one is behind that temptation to avoid the cross, to be saved from this hour. And he knew, the evil one knew, he was about to be driven out. So he's going to get more desperate as we get closer and closer to the cross. Let's look at the fourth example next. Jesus prevailed in the Garden of Gethsemane. Ah, yes, you recognize that. Look with me in Luke chapter 22 here, beginning at verse 40. On reaching the Mount of Olives, Jesus said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." Interesting choice of words here that he uses. He didn't say, "Pray that you don't abandon me," because that's what they did, right? "Pray that you are strong enough to stand with me through to the end," because they didn't. Jesus instead goes to the core problem of all of that, which is temptation. Pray that you will not fall into the temptation to flee, the temptation to abandon, all of the even the temptation of Peter to get mad and take the sword and hack off Malchus's right ear. "Pray that you do not enter into temptation." And then he withdrew about a stone's throw behind them, knelt down, and he prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me." I mean, this is where it culminates, right? In the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus prays, "Father, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." This is in some ways, one of, to me anyway, one of the most difficult passages in the Gospels, because Jesus knows why he came. His purpose was to come and to bring redemption, and yet here he is at that moment, and he wants to get out of it. He does. Father, save me from this hour is in essence what he's saying. What earlier he said, what am I going to say? That? No. Well, now he is. If it be your will, take this cup from me. But he still says, nevertheless, not what I will, but your will be done. He was still submissive to the Father's will, even though he shrank before the terror and the horror of the cross and the prospect of his own Father turning his back on him and abandoning him in that terrible, terrible hour. And that's why I think Luke tells us that an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. He needed it then more than any other time in his life, because he was ready. I mean, he was ready just to go. Jesus modeled here what he told his disciples when he said, pray so that you will not fall into temptation. An angel, we're told, was there to strengthen him, just as when he was tempted in the wilderness. We saw that in Luke's gospel. An angel came and ministered to him. Even Jesus, the Son of God, needed ministering to during these extreme, extreme temptations. I believe that Satan was right there in the garden with him, urging him not to go through with the crucifixion. A number of years ago, a very popular movie was out, and I still like it. I don't have anything bad to say against it, called The Passion of the Christ. Remember that? How many have seen that? Any of you seen The Passion of the Christ? Okay. Do you remember that scene in the Garden of Gethsemane as Jesus is praying? And then you see Satan, this almost like gender-free person. You don't know, is it a man? Is it a woman? The way they make the Satan, the devil character. And remember, he's right there in the garden with him, and he's saying to him, you don't have to go through with this, you know. You know you don't have to. Remember, and then that little snake comes out from underneath Satan's skirts. And I think the symbolism is so powerful when Jesus says, away, and he steps on the head of that snake, because we're told that he would crush the head of the serpent. But that's a very powerful, tempting scene there in the garden. I think it all came crashing in on Jesus then, the reality, not in the sense that he didn't realize it before, but it was just in its fullness now. He's right there on the cusp of the cross, and he says to himself in so many words, I don't want to do this. I don't know if I can. Father, if there's some way for you to take this cup from me, please do it. Other places in the gospel, we're told that it was at this time, in this instant, that Jesus sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. And people question, does it just simply mean regular sweat coming out in the profuse manner that blood would? Others say no, that under situations of extreme duress, that a person can actually sweat blood? I don't know. I kind of like that last one, so I kind of go there. Regardless, we're told that Jesus sweat, as it were, great drops of blood onto the ground. He was tempted. He was tried. He was feeling the pressure of what was going to happen. And yet, he followed through. He prevailed in the Garden of Gethsemane. The next thing I want you to see is Jesus prevailed against the betrayal of Judas and his arrest in the garden. This is kind of like at the end of that time of prayer. I believe that Judas was trying to force Jesus' hand to revolutionary action. People wonder, why did Judas betray the Lord? Well, he was a thief, we're told that. That's part of it. But do you really think it was just the temptation of 30 pieces of silver? I think it was more than that. I think that Judas, just like the rest of the disciples, and frankly, the Jews of that day, they were under the impression that the Messiah would be a military leader, right? The Messiah was going to be a military leader who would deliver Israel from the captivity of Rome, and he would usher in God's golden, what we know today as the millennial kingdom. They expected the Messiah to come in and to do that, to come in riding on a white horse, in a sense, like Revelation describes. But then, at that time, the Messiah would come, destroy the enemies of God, usher in the golden age. And Judas probably hoped that when the rulers went to arrest Jesus, Jesus would then, in a sense, be forced to fight. I think Judas was trying to force his hand here, and then the real revolution would begin, that rather than being arrested, Jesus would be like, All right, boys, let's go. Peter, get your sword out and don't just cut off Malchus's ear, cut off his head. You know, and I think that Judas wanted to see this happen, but when he saw that Jesus did not fight, and when he saw that Jesus actually was going to be crucified, that's when he regretted what he had done and tried to return the money. See, look with me in Matthew 27. We're told that in so many words. Judas, when he had betrayed him, when he saw that Jesus was condemned, okay, that's important, you see? He did not expect Jesus to be condemned. He thought that maybe somehow when push came to shove, that's when they would rise up. But now he sees this is not what's going to happen. When he sees that Jesus is going to be condemned, it says he was seized with remorse. Okay, put them together. It doesn't take a math major to connect the dots. He saw that he was condemned. He was seized with remorse. Put it in reverse. If Jesus was not going to be condemned, then Judas would not be filled with remorse. He wanted Jesus to prevail. He didn't want Jesus to be condemned. He wanted Jesus to rise up as the Messiah should. And when it didn't happen, we're told he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. I have sinned, he said, for I have betrayed innocent blood. When Judas betrayed Jesus, that was a great temptation for Jesus right then to call upon the powers of heaven and upon whatever power his disciples had to fight. Am I just sort of like with a fanciful imagination? I don't think so. Jesus knew that he could be rescued from arrest and torture if he wanted to be. Look with me now to Matthew 26:53. Remember this when Jesus said this. This is at the time of arrest. Do you think that I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? Jesus knew. He's in effect saying, all I have to do is say the word and all the angels of heaven will come to my rescue. You see, my friends, that's where we get that song that we just sang this morning. 12 legions represents roughly about 10,000. He could have called 10,000 angels to destroy the world and set him free. He could have called 10,000 angels, but he died alone for you and me. Jesus, I believe, was tempted here at the point of arrest. And you see it when he says, all I have to do is speak a word and they will come and deliver me. He did not have to go through with it. And in John's gospel account, he adds the words, shall I not drink the cup the Father has given to me? He's referencing his agony in the garden. No doubt this was a very tempting time as well. When they came to arrest him, and Jesus knew this was the moment of truth. It's do or die, buddy. And he chose to die. And all he would have had to do was say the word, and 12 legions of angels would have come. He could have easily escaped arrest. He could have destroyed his captors with a word. But he prevailed against this strong temptation to avoid the cross. But he died alone for you and me. Finally, the last thing, Jesus prevailed against the final temptation to come down from the cross. Now, what I'm about to reference next could be misunderstood by some. I know that in the Christian community, when this movie came out, people were aghast, they were offended, and I've seen the movie, and I understand why in some ways it presents Jesus as a man who doesn't really understand his mission. There's just some weird, funky stuff going on there related to John the Baptist and naked women dancing and just, you know, crap. Sorry, that's what it is. It's garbage. But at the same time, the overall message of this movie was fascinating to me. What I'm talking about is the last temptation of Christ. Remember when that movie came out in the 80s or early 90s, I forget which, and people just went nuts against it, and with good reason in some ways, but in another way, I don't remember if it was Quentin Tarantino who directed it or somebody else, but anyway, it was a fascinating question, and the whole premise of the movie is the idea that Jesus is on the cross And he says, that's enough. I'm done. And he gets down off the cross. I can't do it. He gets down off the cross. He gets married. And he has children, I think. And then years later, it's like he has an epiphany. And he goes, what have I done? What have I done? I failed in my one mission to redeem the world. And I don't even remember if he ends. Oh, I know what happens. And at that moment, suddenly we're flashed back to the cross scene and we realize this has all been, in a sense, a dream, a daydream, an imagination, a temptation to Christ while he was on the cross. That was the last temptation of Christ, to come down off the cross. And from that standpoint, you don't have to watch the garbage movie to understand and appreciate that. From that standpoint, that was ingenious, because it walked you all the way through the sort of ramifications of what could have been going through Jesus' mind. What if I get down from here? You think that wasn't a temptation? Remember that the crowd and the rulers and even the criminals being executed next to him all made it very tempting for him to show them who he really was. You remember that? If not, I'll remind you. Let's look to Matthew 27. Those who passed by hurled insults, shaking their heads and saying, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross if you are the Son of God. And he's suffering, right? He's dying on this cross. What temptation it must have been for him to say, I'll show you. Let's keep going. Look at the next slide. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders, all of the religious rulers mocked him. Oh, he saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, I am the Son of God. See, now they're putting God's veracity on the line. If he's really the Son of God, if he really trusts in God, if God is really with him, well then get down off the cross and prove it to us. And again, in the midst of all of that pain and agony and suffering and dying, don't think that that wasn't a temptation for Jesus. It wasn't as though it just blew past him like the wind. No doubt he thought about that. What happens if? What happens if? And look to this passage in Luke 23. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself. And us. Let's us get in on it too. All of these things, I think in some ways, this final temptation was perhaps the most tempting of all. There he is, suffering. He'd been beaten to within an inch of his life. The crown of thorns, all of that going on, being on the cross with the nails through his wrists and his legs, the excruciating pain. Being forsaken by the Father. Remember, this is when it happened. This is when Jesus cried out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? He had never through all eternity ever been separated from his Father. Not one time. I am at the Father's side. I always do those things that please him. This is what Jesus enjoyed from eternity past as the second person of the Godhead, the eternal Son of God. But now he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? God has turned his back on him as he charges him with the sin of his people. And at that moment, people are saying, you know, you can come down. And Jesus knew it was true. He could. He could still just speak a word and everything would be finished and he'd be down off of that cross. Don't tell me that's not tempting. It would be tempting for you. And it would be tempting for me. It was very tempting for the Son of God. These were very real suggestions. He could have called 10,000 angels to destroy the world and set him free. He could have called 10,000 angels, but he died alone for you and me. Let's remind ourselves again what I'm trying to get across to you this morning. Jesus prevailed against Satan's temptations to avoid the cross in so many ways, as we've seen. And these are just six of them. There are probably more. Where Adam and Israel and we have all failed against temptation, Jesus alone has prevailed. He prevailed again and again and again and again. Jesus, the second Adam, does not bring us condemnation and guilt and sin like the first Adam did. No, He brings to us justification and life and forgiveness. And He brings something else too. He brings help for us in the here and now during, by comparison, silly little Lenten seasons like we go through to give up little minor things like a TV show or Coca-Cola or chocolate or cookies. And yes, now I am mocking. I mean, if you're doing that, I don't mean to be like saying that's stupid, don't do it. No, do it. But understand too how minuscule that is compared to the temptations that Jesus fought against. First, having gone 40 days, 40 nights without food or water. And then all of these other temptations that we saw. And now when we face temptations, not just in little Lenten season things, but the larger things where we are tempted to cheat, to steal, to lie, to criticize, to judge. Remember Hebrews 2:18. Because He Himself suffered when He was tempted, He is able to help those who are tempted. You come to a great high priest. You come to one who is able to empathize with your weaknesses. You know why? Because He went through the exact same thing. And He prevailed, and so can you. That's why Hebrews 2 tells us that. He suffered when He was tempted, then He is eminently qualified to give aid to those who are tempted. Run to Him. I mean, run to Him when you're tempted and cry out and say, Jesus, You know what this is like. You've been there before and probably 10 times worse than what I'm dealing with now. So please help me. Give me the strength that You had when You prevailed against temptation. Give me the strength to shut my mouth. Give me the strength to remain true. Give me the strength to speak truth in love. Whatever the situation might be, go to Him and ask Him to help you. And we are promised in Hebrews 2 that He will help those who call upon Him. That's our confidence and that's our hope. The wonderful cross that Jesus went to, it was a place of ignominy and shame, but He turned it into a place of glory, to where now people wear images of this terrible means of death, not because they want to magnify this terrible means of death, but they want to magnify the Savior who died there for us. And that terrible, terrible cross has now become the wonderful cross. Let's stand together and sing this wonderful hymn.